You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Joining me as always, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. Happy Victory Monday. Hope everyone enjoyed the Seahawks 37-27 win over the 49ers at CenturyLink Field. It actually was not quite as anxiety-inducing as most of the other games earlier this season, though. Of course, the Seahawks had to make it kind of interesting in the fourth quarter because that seems to be what this football team loves to do. Built Bar is a protein bar that tastes like a candy bar. Go to BuiltBar.com and use promo code LOCKEDON and you'll get 20% off your next order. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. With six starters and a key reserve sidelined on Sunday, the Seahawks had every reason to fold against the 49ers, but after a sluggish start on offense, a couple three and outs, the offense got rolling with a 46-yard touchdown from Russell Wilson to DK Metcalf, created a few turnovers, and suddenly it was 30-7 midway through the third quarter. Ended up holding on for a 10-point victory. The 49ers were able to put 20 points on the board in the fourth quarter to make this game look closer than it really was. But in the scheme of things, it was a convincing win. Arguably the most convincing win they've had this season. Even the Falcons game was pretty close for most of the game. This one, once Seattle got rolling, they were really in control for most of this football game, even with that late flurry from the 49ers. And Rob, they're now 6-1. They're the only 6-1 team in the NFC. They are the number one seed right now in the conference. They're in first place in the NFC West. The Cardinals and the Rams just behind them. The Rams did lose their third game of the season yesterday to the Miami Dolphins. So that was a big win for the Dolphins and a big win for the Seahawks, giving them a little bit of separation from their division rivals. And the Packers lost as well. So that's what allows the Seahawks to now be by themselves atop the conference, which is a really big deal now at the halfway point of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. I'm happy that you mentioned is the halfway point in the season. Of course, the Seahawks sitting at 6-1. So there's the seven games. And then obviously they had their bye week as well. So we are officially halfway through the NFL's regular season. And as you mentioned, Corbin, the Seahawks are staying alone at the top of not only the NFC West, but the entire NFC. And so if this season is going to continue as expected, and there is only the one seed that is able to get a bye, then the Seahawks have put themselves in excellent position. You know, you take a step back and think about where we were at on, as you put it, Misery Monday, when the Seahawks lost that game against the Cardinals, and everything looked like it was very much up in the air. But to have this divisional game against the 49ers that looked like they were the team that was about to get hot, and instead Seattle came out more aggressive, more physical, and obviously the victorious team, I think that we are talking about a whole different scenario in week 8 in the NFL after the Seahawks' convincing win over the 49ers.
And what's interesting about all of this, you mentioned if the Seahawks are able to have that one seed, and if that format is going to be kept, then they will have the bye. The competition committee today apparently was discussing on a Zoom call a potential move to a 16-team format, and this is only if there are games canceled due to COVID before the end of the season. They're trying to come up with a fair way. If there's a team that missed a game due to the virus and they feel like they deserve to be in the playoffs, they're trying to make it as fair as possible given very unideal circumstances. But if that happened, the Seahawks would not get a bye. They would just be the number one seed, and they'd be playing at home, which right now, with no fans in the stands, really not home field advantage anyway. The Seahawks have not lost yet at home, so maybe that's still something that's a positive for them. But nonetheless, if that happened right now, and we were looking at eight teams making the postseason, the 49ers would be the last one out, because the NFC East has to have a playoff team. They have to have a division champion, which right now would be the 3-4-1 Eagles. The rest of the playoff standings would look like this. The Seahawks would win the NFC West at 6-1. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers would win the South at 5-2. And then you've got the Green Bay Packers. Even though they lost to the Vikings yesterday, they're still 5-2. They would win the NFC North as well. The Saints, the Bears, and the Rams would be, and as well as the Cardinals, those would be your four wild card teams under that scenario. If it was the normal 7-team playoff, then the Rams and 49ers would both be on the outside looking in right now. The Chicago Bears would be the last wild card team in the NFC. So, you know, that's something to kind of throw in there, that maybe we might have a little different looking playoff season. I'm sure the Seahawks, being atop the NFC right now, are hoping there aren't any more interferences that are created by this virus, and they will be able to have that bye week if they can hold on to that number one seed. But nonetheless, this is as good of a start as you could have asked for. They would have loved to win that game in Arizona, but even with that loss, still have the number one seed and look to be the favorite right now. I think the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are probably the biggest threat in the NFC with the way they're playing the last couple weeks.
No, I would agree with you, Corbin. I mean, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I give them a lot of credit. Bruce Arians, head coach, Jason Light, general manager, obviously Tom Brady is the quarterback, who has very much sparked just a incomplete and total turnaround by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at 5-2. But at the same time, they are a full game behind the Seahawks at this point, and they could be very much more as we move forward, because that is a team that has had some significant losses. Everybody's going to focus in on the significant addition that Antonio Brown could be for that team, you know, kind of playing the bunk buddy, the bunk bed buddy with Tom and Gisele Brady in Tampa Bay. And it's going to be interesting to see how that all works out. But as we've talked about before, the Buccaneers are a team that lost a significant piece with the injury to Vita Vea, their big run stuffer in the middle. And the Seahawks, on the other hand, Corbin, seem to be getting healthier as the season moves on. Obviously, the big splashy trade for Jamal Adams, but he has been gone for a couple of weeks. It sounded like Pete Carroll was pretty optimistic that Adams would be able to return, if not this week against the Buffalo Bills, and certainly very, very soon. Obviously, Seattle was a pretty much hamstrung at the running back position in their victory against the 49ers, and yet still were able to have a victory, even with DJ Dallas as a rookie running back being kind of the focal point of your running game. You expect to have Chris Carson back. Possibly you're going to have Rashad Penny back. Possibly you're going to have Carlos Hyde back. So I think the Seahawks have to be ecstatic where they are in the season at this point, staying there at 6-1. Wherever the rules are at the end of the season, the Seahawks, if they can maintain this stretch, then they will have the number one seed in the playoffs. And whether they have the bye, as is normally the case, or not, to have the number one seed in the NFC, I think would be a significant step for this team, because I do believe that it is a statement about where they are in terms of the rest of the NFL. And what I mean by that is that they are a legitimate Super Bowl contender.
And historically, the Seahawks have been the number one seed three other times, and guess what? They've went to the Super Bowl all three of those times. Obviously, the home field advantage has been a big part of that over the years, but again, just being that number one seed, being able to play in Seattle, that would certainly help their chances of getting back to the Super Bowl for the first time since 2014. When we come back, we're going to tackle your questions. It's time for our Monday mailbag segment. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Thanks to a lack of natural athleticism or commitment or overbearing sports parents, fewer than 1% of 1% of 1% of people will ever play professional football. But instead of entering the NFL, they've joined another league, the League of Football Watchers. This football season will be different, and Pepsi is here to get you ready for game day, no matter how you watch. Whether you're like me watching Russ cook from the press box or watching with friends and family at home, Pepsi is the refreshment you need to power through any game day. Because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game, it's made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith. Joining me for our Monday show, Rob Rang. Later in the third quarter, the Seahawks picking up a big win over their division rivals, the 49ers, yesterday, 37-27. We're going to look at the best defensive performance of the season, at least for three quarters, I may add, from the Seahawks in yesterday's victory. But first, Let's get to your questions. It's our weekly Locked On Seahawks mailbag segment. First one coming from Ron King tweets, what's the defensive back rotation look like with a healthy Shaquille Griffin and DJ Reed in the mix? I think this is a very interesting question right now, particularly when you look at DJ Reed, because Ugo Amadi might not even be back yet this week based on what Pete Carroll's saying. And the longer he's out, the better chance that DJ Reed could maybe steal this job from him.
Well, and DJ Reed did a heck of a job against his former team, the San Francisco 49ers. I mean, he was spectacular. He tied with Bobby Wagner to lead the Seahawks in solo tackles with 6 against the 49ers. He showed, you know, the great quick twitch, coverage ability. And then there were some times that he was beaten. That's going to happen if you're going to play a nickel cornerback spot. But at the same time, his presence on the field was undeniable, Corbin. I look forward to kind of breaking it down a little bit more. In the third quarter, we're going to take some defensive takeaways. But I think that this is a conversation, really, that is something that the Seahawks fans should be very excited about. You know Shaquille Griffin is going to be a starter when he is healthy and able to return. He is your best cover corner. It's not even a debate. You feel good about the way Trey Flowers played. You feel good about the way Quentin Dunbar played against the 49ers. And certainly you feel good about DJ Reed. Ugo Amadi has shown some flashes. You know that Nick Corner is a position of concern. But I am very, very excited about the fact that DJ Reed was able to come in, have the immediate impact that he was against the 49ers, but also because he offers the same type of positional versatility that Ugo Amadi has. So to me, this is a conversation about let the best man win. Whoever is the hottest player, that player clearly right now is DJ Reed, and will remains to be seen where if Ugo Amadi is able to scratch out a little bit more playing time when he is healthy and able to return to the field.
And here's the thing, Ugo Amadi has played pretty darn well since he took over for Marquise Blair when Blair tore his ACL in week 2. He's had several really good games playing that slot corner position. The last couple games, he'd given up a few more completions in the passing game and missed a couple tackles. But overall, I think he's done a nice job. But like Pete Carroll said after the game last night, when he gets back, him versus Reed, that is going to be a fun competition. And that's just how the Seahawks like it. So those two are going to be competing against each other for snaps each week. It's a nice little conundrum to have with two athletic players that can do a lot of different things. Both these guys are really good blitzers from the slot corner position. We haven't seen Amadi make an impact in that regard in game action yet to this point, but we saw what Reed could do blitzing from that corner spot yesterday. He's a little bit of a pest in coverage as well. Got his first career interception yesterday. Really athletic and energetic player. Both these guys play with great energy. So they've got an interesting competition coming up there. The outside cornerback spots, I really don't think it's going to mess with the rotation. As you said, Griffin is going to be a starter when he's healthy alongside Quentin Dunbar. Trey Flowers is going to be the number 3 guy that can come in the snap and play either side. And I do think it's interesting when you look behind him, because when Ryan Neal's not in the lineup and Jamal Adams is playing, Ryan Neal has a cornerback background. So he also gives you another long-armed, big-body guy that can play on the outside, and he can play both safety positions. And maybe he's a guy that can rotate in certain sub-packages. If you need a big nickel, maybe Ryan Neal can be that guy. So a lot of options here. It's a good problem to have. And with a team that's struggled giving up so many passing yards all season, having that kind of depth and versatility is going to be key to making sure that this unit turns things around. They've got 9 more games left to play, so a lot of football for them to continue working on improving that pass defense. Seahawks Realm tweets, with Philip Dorsett's status up in the air, could John Ross be an option as the trade deadline nears? I know Seattle fans would love seeing John Ross come to the Pacific Northwest, being a former Washington Husky star. I just don't know that the draft capital's there, and quite frankly, from what I've been hearing, the Bengals really don't have any interest in making a move there.
Yeah, I would be stunned if the Seahawks pulled off a trade for John Ross, and I agree with you, Corbin. I think that there's a lot of Seahawks fans that are also University of Washington Husky fans or Pac-12 fans, and they remember fondly what John Ross was able to provide the Huskies, and there is no question that he offers a similar skill set as Philip Dorsett in terms of possessing quite literally the fastest straight line 40-yard dash of all time. And so there's no doubt that, yeah, if you're able to add John Ross and be able to, you know, basically replace Philip Dorsett as that speed threat, if the Cincinnati Bengals are just going to give him away, then sure, you would take the number 9 overall pick a couple of years back for you know, a 7th round selection if the Cincinnati Bengals are going to give him away. But they're not going to give him away, as you just mentioned, Corbin. And I think, frankly, as much as the Seahawks might be fans of the University of Washington program, one thing that we've seen over and over again is the Seahawks are going to be looking for players who are reliable. You think about the players that they've traded for in the past and the players that they've been burned by. The players they've been burned by have been guys who have been unable to stay on the field. And that's exactly the issue that John Ross has had. So I would be stunned. I think if there is a possibility the Seahawks do pull off another late trade to improve this roster, I would be surprised if it's the wide receiver position, and I would be absolutely shocked if it would be a player who has had the durability concerns. As talented as he is, as much as I would love to see John Ross return to Pacific Northwest, I would be shocked if it happens in the next couple of days and the Seahawks make a trade for John Ross from the Cincinnati Bengals, considering the draft issues that they have as far as which picks they have, and again, the durability concerns that John Ross has shown since he entered the NFL.
You're right. He hasn't been reliable. He's been hurt a lot. And that dates back to his college career, too. He had some injury issues at Washington, missed large chunks of games from pretty significant injuries. So I just don't see the Seahawks doing this. I'm with you. There's a chance there could be another trade before the deadline tomorrow. But if they do make a move, you're going to basically be saying, well, we're going to get this guy for week 10 because of the new COVID protocol. So I'd be surprised if we see many more deals. This is not a trade that I see happening, even though it'd be cool to see John Ross back in the Pacific Northwest. I don't see this happening, and I don't think the Bengals are interested in making this move. JD Thomas tweets, do you think Seattle will make a trade for another pass rusher? They've already looked at Alden Smith. What about somebody like Tack McKinley? I think it's pretty obvious, Rob, that the Seahawks are still looking at pass rushers. I just don't know what options there really are out there, because from what Tack McKinley tweeted today on his own personal account, he's going to be staying put. The Falcons have denied several offers for him, so it doesn't look like he's going anywhere. Alden Smith's not going to be traded because the Cowboys at 2-6 still think they are in the NFC East race, and really they are, because it's the worst division that I've ever seen. So if they were able to rattle off a couple wins with Andy Dalton to come back, they could be right back in the swing of things trying to compete for a division title. So they're not moving him. There's just not a lot of other options unless you were able to get Washington to part ways with Ryan Kerrigan, which, again, if you're reading through the tea leaves, it doesn't look like Washington has interest in doing that, even though he has just 1 year left in his contract.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I would be surprised if Seattle was able to pull off another trade. I mean, they are severely lacking the draft capital to be able to pull off any type of a deal. I just think that the teams that are going to be willing to trade players have already pretty much done so. As you mentioned, Tack McKinley, appears to be getting reports from the Atlanta Brain Trust that he is not going to be on the trading block. I think that he would be a player the Seahawks would be interested in if he were available. I'm not so sure that would be the case with a player. We've talked about Everson Griffin before, Alden Smith, players like that who, again, have had some questions about their reliability. It's not just about durability, physically being able to be on the field, but the reliability, whether or not you can trust these players to be on the field. If you are going to make a deal at this point in the season, as you mentioned, Corbin, you're talking about week 10. You're talking about players who are going to be able to be kind of like we talked about in baseball, in the October Summer League and things like that, to be able to make a big move at the very end of the season to kind of push you into the playoffs. I'm not so sure that any of those players are. The guy who I think that they do believe can make that type of a push, they already traded for in Carlos Dunlap, a player that you and I kind of gushed about when the Seahawks made that trade, about his durability, his consistency, his ability to make impact plays against the run and the pass. I think for Seahawks fans who are looking for a big-time addition, you already got one in Carlos Dunlap, and you're hoping that the others come off of the injury report for the Seahawks and are able to make the big-time immediate impacts. Guys like Jamal Adams, possibly possibly Daryl Taylor, possibly guys like whether it be a Philip Dorsett, a Chris Carson, Rashad Penny. But that's one of the most exciting things for me about the Seahawks, Corbin, is that this is a team that looks really good right now. And you think about the players that they potentially could have coming back, it would almost be like pulling off a big trade, considering the talent, the Pro Bowlers that they still have waiting on the sidelines.
And I've talked about this a couple times. Rashad Penny, to me, when he comes back from the PUP list, that is a trade deadline acquisition, because you're adding a different type of weapon in the backfield that they just don't have right now with any of their running backs. JR tweets, is this the best special teams unit in the NFL? You know, if you would have asked me this a few weeks ago, I would have said, it's way too early. We're only a few games into the season. But I think right now, getting ready to go into week 9, that you can make a strong argument that this is the best special teams unit overall in the NFL. Their kick coverage is fantastic. We saw yesterday again, Cody Barton blowing up Dante Pettis and forcing a fumble. Middle of third quarter, Seattle gets the ball right back and they go down and score. And now it's suddenly 27-7. That really broke the game open. We saw DeMontre Moore. He's not going to be playing anymore till at least week 15, unfortunately. But we've seen him make some big hits on kick coverage. You've seen Michael Dickson consistently. He's become a cheat code to an extent with his ability to pin opponents inside their own 5-yard line. He did it again yesterday at the end of the first half, and the 49ers had to wave the white flag because, well, we're not going to drive 95 yards in less than a minute and a half. So they ended up taking a knee. And so they went into the halftime, and they were trailing at that point. When you consider how well he's playing, the special teams units are doing a nice job. Jason Myers missed an extra point yesterday, but otherwise he has been perfect in field goals and extra points the rest of the season. He's having a really nice year. The only area I could nitpick is I wish they could bust a kick return, but anymore in the NFL, most kickoffs are going out of the end zone anyway, so you don't even get a lot of opportunities to make impact plays in that regard. But otherwise, this has been a fantastic unit on special teams all the way around. Larry Izzo deserves a ton of credit in that interim special teams coordinator role.
He really does, Corbin. I'm happy that you mentioned that. I mean, mention Larry Izzo by name. Mention the very first thing that you said as far as special teams wasn't the punts, wasn't the field goals, which is what most people focus on. It was the punt coverage, the kick coverage. Seattle has been absolutely spectacular in that way. You know, we were gushing about the way that, the Cody Barton made the big play against the Minnesota Vikings, just showed that physicality, helped, you know, make that big fourth down stop. And for him to be able to transfer that onto the special teams field and be able to force that fumble was a huge play for the Seahawks. Sure, you wish that Jason Myers would have made the extra PAT, after DK Metcalf's initial touchdown to kind of get Seattle onto the board. Sure. But at the same time, he's made every other kick. Michael Dickson, and that particular punt that you referenced, 65 yards, get dropped on the 1-yard line, is absolutely spectacular. Corbin, I've been watching college football all weekend long, and I saw a lot of really, really good punts over the college football and NFL day. But most of the punts that stuck at about the 5-yard line or less were punts that netted 30 yards, 40 yards, 50 yards. There's a lot of guys that can put the ball straight up into the air and then get their punt coverage or kick coverage team to be able to down it at the 1 or 2 or 3 yard line.
But they're not magicians like he is.
Just kick it 65 yards and then plug it there. I mean, that is pulling out your pitching wedge and sticking it. And that's exactly what he was able to do in a huge game against a divisional opponent who, oh, by the way, was a couple of plays away from winning the Super Bowl. So, again, I think that special teams deserves a great deal of credit, that they had their best performance of the year so far. And I would agree with both you, Corbin, as well as the person who posed the question in the first place. I really do believe that the Seattle Seahawks right now are having as good a special teams play as you're seeing in all of the NFL.
A last question here coming from Ryan T. Tweets, which players have improved the most during the first half of the season? We're not quite to the halfway point for the Seahawks. They've played 7 games, but through these first 7 games, I think the first name that I'm going to throw out here, and we're talking most improved players, I have got to go with Ethan Posick on this. He has played flat-out outstanding this year, replacing Justin Britt at his natural position at center. And I felt like the first couple games, well, we need to see a larger sample size before I'm willing to jump into the pond here and say that Ethan Posick is your guy at center, and maybe he's going to be the starter beyond 2020. Now I think it looks like it would be very wise for the Seahawks to get him extended if they can. Bring him back, still a very young player. He's at the position where he's best suited to play in the NFL, and he's doing a fantastic job as the anchor of that offensive line. So to me, he's the most improved offensive player on defense. I don't know who you could say other than Ryan Neal with what he's contributed, a guy that's been a practice squad player his first couple years in the league. For him to come in and play as well as he hasn't been quite as good the last couple games, but he's still playing solid at that strong safety position, still making some key plays for the Seahawks. So that's a no-brainer for me. He's got to be your most improved defensive guy in the first half.
Yeah, Corbin, you're such a pro. I mean, those are the players that I was thinking about as well. Ethan Posick, maybe a little bit of a tip of the cap, Damian Lewis at the right guard position just as a rookie. But Ethan Posick, Ryan Neal, I think that you can give some credit to a player like a Jordan Brooks, the improvement that he's played, maybe a Brian Monet, considering that some people thought that he was kind of a flash in the pan, undrafted free agent his first season. But Seattle has brought in some other players, and Anthony Rush obviously signed Damon Harrison, and yet Monet continues to get the bulk of the action inside. I think any of those players are the ones that mentioned, but if you were to ask me my number one player on offense, it would have been Ethan Posick. Number two player on defense, it would have been Ryan Neal, the same two players that you just mentioned.
And I'm going to throw one more name in the fire, too, because David Moore has been fantastic this year. And this kind of goes off a question that we had here, and it was from John David Fraley of Field Goals, was asking how underrated David Moore is. So I'll just answer it as part of this. David Moore, right now, is one of the most underrated receivers in the NFL. He's on pace for over 500 receiving yards and 7 touchdowns as Seattle's third receiver. And I think what makes this all the more impressive, Rob, is that he's playing on an offense where Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf any given week are getting 12, 13, 14, 15, even 20 targets in a game by themselves. The football can only go to so many guys in one game. And so he's had limited opportunities, and yet he's caught 16 of his 20 targets, an 80% catch rate. Some of those have been really difficult catches. He had 2 rushes for 28 yards yesterday, so he's a threat running the ball in jet sweeps, and you can use him on screens. And so David Moore is another guy that I'd be remiss not to mention, because he's really made that leap from year 3 to year 4, where he has really emerged as one of the NFL's best number 3 receivers. When we come back for the third quarter, we're going to look at some defensive takeaways from the Seahawks' 37-27 victory over the 49ers. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Victory Monday edition. I'm your host, Corbin Smith. Joining me as always, Rob Rang. The Seahawks back in the win column. After losing in Arizona, they get a 37-27 victory over the 49ers. That the final score made it look much closer than it really was. The Seahawks went into the fourth quarter up 30-7 and ended up holding on for the 10-point victory. The defense, we're going to be talking about here in a moment, maybe the biggest negative was the way they finished this game, giving up 3 touchdown drives after Nick Mullins stepped in for Jimmy Garoppolo. So that was a letdown. But nonetheless, Rob, we got to see 3 quarters of really good defensive football from the Seahawks. And it all started with the man in the middle. This might have been one of the top 3 performances for Bobby Wagner in his career. He was all over the place. The Seahawks were aggressive, blitzing him more often than normal, and he was getting home. He was running over offensive linemen and then making sacks. That was one of the best sacks for a linebacker that I've ever seen yesterday, his second one. I mean, he bowled over a couple of offensive linemen and then kept fighting, got the sack on Jimmy Garoppolo, finished with a game-high 11 tackles. He had 4 quarterback hits, 3 tackles for a loss. I mean, this truly was a vintage game for the future Hall of Famer, and he set the tone for the rest of Seattle's defense.
It was a great performance by Bobby Wagner. I'm happy that we're starting off right here with the way that he performed, because, of course, You know, a week ago, we were talking about number 54 for the San Francisco 49ers and what a terrific player that Fred Warner is becoming for that team. But maybe I, and I don't want to put you under the bus, Corbin, but maybe I and others were a little quick to not give Bobby Wagner his credit. And again, I think that Bobby Wagner deserves a great deal of credit. I think that, you know, Seattle's coaches deserve a great deal of credit. You know, I mean, I just think that it was absolutely phenomenal that you had a team that had all of the injury concerns that this club had, whether it be along the defensive line, whether it be at the linebacker position, whether it be in the secondary. You're going up against a team that the San Francisco 49ers are not the same club that they were a year ago. But still, this is a team that was, you know, a couple of seconds away from winning an NFL championship a year ago. And so I thought there was every reason to suspect that the Seahawks might fall down or lay down in this game. And instead, Ken Norton Jr. was more aggressive than I've seen him generally be in play calling. And certainly that unleashed Bobby Wagner and all those opportunities to rush the passer. I mean, I haven't seen a linebacker use a swim move as good as that. I mean, it looked like Michael Phelps in the Olympics. I mean, the way that he was using that overarm swim move to be able to get by the would-be blockers and just be able to wreak havoc, you know, as far as a pass rusher. Not something you normally expect to see Bobby Wagner do. He was good in coverage. He was good against the run. The Seahawks absolutely shut down that vaunted San Francisco running attack, and all of it had a great deal to do with the spectacular play of Bobby Wagner. So absolutely, tip of the cap to number 54, had a spectacular game for the Seahawks, and it's a huge reason why that they are now 6-1.
And you mentioned the aggressiveness from Ken Norton Jr. You got to wonder how much he was hearing the noise this past weekend. And you could even say Bobby Wagner. And I'm glad that you didn't throw me under the bus, because I have been on the side that Bobby Wagner is still Bobby Wagner. And he's not regressing. He's still an elite all-pro linebacker. And there's been plenty of people out there telling me you're crazy. But he's been playing well all year, despite having limited help around him and players underachieving around him. He's been kind of the glue guy for this defense. And finally yesterday, I think that he had seen enough. He was tired of it. Like he said the week before, we're not talking anymore about this. We need to go out and get it done. And so he just went out and put the onus on himself. We're not going to be ran over the way that we have been the last couple weeks. I'm going to dominate this football game. And Ken Norton Jr. allowed him to do so by sending him on more blitzes in this game. So it was a lot of fun to see the future Hall of Famer go to work and just single-handedly wreck the 49ers game plan. And then DJ Reed, I think, is the other player. And we're talking about aggressiveness. You mentioned this in the second quarter. He was blitzed 3 or 4 times in this game from the nickel corner spot. And every time that he came on the blitz, something good happened. In the second quarter, the first time that they sent him, he was going after Jimmy Garoppolo, and he ended up missing out on the sack. He had a wrap on him, but Garoppolo escaped. But that was the play that Bobby Wagner ended up getting into the backfield and getting his first sack. And it was after he bowled over a couple of linemen and then got to Garoppolo. And that resulted from DJ Reed's pressure. And then in the third quarter, Reed came in untouched again on the blitz, and Garoppolo stepped up and Alton Robinson sacked him. By the way, Alton Robinson had a fantastic game in his first NFL start, replacing Benson Maiyoua. So right there, really my three big performers. DJ Reed with the interception against his former team, had some really nice blitzes that set up teammates for sacks. Also had a couple of pass deflections playing the slot corner position again. He and Ugo Amadi are going to have a really fun competition coming up here for the rest of the season, just fighting for reps on game day. I could see both of them getting snaps at that slot corner position.
Yeah, you just mentioned three of the players that I really want to make sure that we highlight here, because they were absolutely spectacular. I mean, again, we talked about Bobby Wagner, DJ Reed. I mean, not only was he productive as a pass rusher, and again, you have to give a lot of the credit to the Seahawks coaches, because they put their players in positions to succeed. And this was a San Francisco team that, of course, once they lost Jimmy Garoppolo, the fact that they were already limited with Debo Samuel and the injuries that they've had at the running back position, it did put the Seahawks in a position to be able to attack. I just like that the Seahawks took advantage of that and decided to attack. back rather than play soft. And that's what happened a little bit in the fourth quarter. And if you're going to criticize the Seahawks because they knew that they had the game in the bag and they were just trying to let the time run out successfully, I might add, then fine. You can criticize them for Nick Mullins coming in there and looking like a superstar at the end. But at the same time, this team was absolutely dominant over the first three quarters against a team that, again, as I mentioned for the third time tonight, was in the Super Bowl a year ago.
And played well the last 2 weeks.
Exactly. And so it's a very encouraging sign. But, DJ Reed, I thought that he had a nice game as far as rushing the passer. I like the coverage skills that he showed. And I just would ask you, just think as a human being, how much of an emotional factor that might be as a player that as San Francisco 49ers know, that the DJ Reed was an impact player for them. And the Seahawks stole him away when San Francisco incorrectly ascertained that he would not be available this season. We talked about this before. The Seahawks stole him from the 49ers roster for him to come back in this game against the 49ers. To me, you could almost feel it. And there, of course, was not fans in CenturyLink, but you could almost feel the change of momentum when DJ Reed made that interception. That was when the game, to me, really started turning in Seattle's favor. And then for you to mention Alton Robinson again, he had the sack. He had the penalty, but still, I always want to reward the young players who are playing aggressively. And it wasn't just the pass rush that Alton Robinson was able to provide. It was the danger factor, the unknown factor. San Francisco doesn't know what Alton Robinson has, and that's the thing. Is the Seahawks have a couple other players that very few teams out there know what Jamal Adams can bring, know what Damon Harris can bring, and they're starting to figure out what Jordan Brooks can bring. And all of those players, I think, are going to be key to Seattle's success moving forward.
I think the biggest key to this football game early was the Seahawks' ability to shut down the 49ers' ground game. And we talked about this last week when we were looking at key matchups, individual players. And then on Friday's show with Nick Lee, we were talking defensive game plan. Priority 1, 2, and 3 was stopping that run game that's got so many bells and whistles. And Kyle Shanahan does such a fantastic job motioning players, moving guys around to try to create extra gaps and put defenses into the front that they want them to be in to run against. And yet the Seahawks seemed oblivious to that yesterday. They did a fantastic job being disciplined, maintained their run fits and their gaps, and they limited the 49ers to just 48 rushing yards in the first half. They ended the game with 2.8 yards per carry. This is a run offense that, even with some of the injuries that they've had this year, they've got a really solid offensive line and they've got great depth at that running back spot. They are in the top 10 in pretty much every category, and they entered with the most rushing touchdowns in the NFL. They got one from Jamichael Hasty, and that was the only touchdown they scored the first three quarters. Otherwise, the Seahawks pretty much completely shut down their run game, and a big part of that was the defensive end play. I thought LJ Collier did a really nice job at the base end spot defending the run, and Alton Robinson did an excellent job with his run fits and maintaining the edge. And this is a 49ers team that wants to get to the edge with their run game, running their outside zone packages and stuff. They were not able to do that in this football game, and that was a big reason that instantly the 49ers became one-dimensional. Jimmy Garoppolo wasn't playing well, and he was playing at less than 100%, was making some bad decisions. And when you put the ball in his court and he didn't have the running game to lean on, this game got away from the 49ers quickly. So I give all the credit as a team defensively for the Seahawks doing what they did, bottling up the 49ers run game, forcing the 49ers to become one-dimensional. And really, that's what won in the ball game in the first half going into the third quarter.
Exactly. You said it, one-dimensional. I mean, the San Francisco 49ers, actually beat Seattle. They had 351 total yards to Seattle's 350. But of that 350 for Seattle, 101 of those, so basically a third, were in the running game. And this is, again, going against a very talented San Francisco defense with Seattle lacking their normal assortment of running backs, and yet still were able to have a third of their yardage created via the running game. And the San Francisco 49ers, a team whose whole offense, Kyle Shanahan, as much respect as I have for him, as well as his father, Mike Shanahan, and their ability to generate the running game, 351 total yards, but only 52 came via the running game, averaging 2.4 yards per attempt. I mean, that's pathetic. You're not going to be able to win an NFL game if that's what you're going to be doing, at least not very consistently. And then if you have the injuries to Jimmy Garoppolo, you have the injuries to George Kittle, it made the San Francisco 49ers essentially one-handed and unable to be able to compete with the Seahawks in this game. And that is why at the end of the third quarter, this game was 30-7, and Seattle laughed them their way to a victory.
Yeah, and you can say they coasted the last quarter. Again, that's my biggest negative from this game defensively, is that the Seahawks were so dominant the first three quarters, and then fourth quarter, Nick Mullins was just throwing all over the field on him. And here's the thing, he made some throws that were really, really good with getting hit by, he had pressure coming, he got blasted a couple times. There was a completion he made to Kittle that he just threaded between two defenders while he was getting hit. So like Carroll said after the game, sometimes you just got to give the other team credit. They've got guys that want to win too, and Mullins has had some decent games in the NFL when he's filled in for Garoppolo. So I don't think that that was that big of a deal. Obviously, they were playing more of a prevent defense at that point. They were just letting the 49ers work their way up and down the field, but chewing up some clock in the process. I think probably the thing that was most disappointing about that, and this goes with my other negative here, the Seahawks had chances to create additional turnovers and didn't capitalize. There was a play where, this was right before DJ Reed intercepted Garoppolo, so it ended up not being a big deal, but they forced a fumble from Jamichael Hasty, and you had Ryan Neal that was trying to recover it, and unfortunately he rolled out of bounds while touching the football, so they weren't able to get possession of it. And then on one of those touchdown drives late, Quentin Dunbar, he's already dropped a couple gimme interceptions this year. He had another one in his hand in the red zone, and it was right in his grasp, and he just couldn't hang on to it. So that would be the other thing I'd nitpick about a little bit. They had some opportunities to create some turnovers in this game. They didn't finish, but nonetheless, this was still easily the best game they've played, and for three quarters, this looked like a really good defense. It was a great stepping stone. You're going to get a lot of players back here in the next week or two. Jamal Adams, Shaquille Griffin, Benson Maioa. You're going to have Carlos Dunlap make his debut. You get those pieces there with some of the other players that debuted in this game, like a DJ Reed, Elton Robinson with his first start, and things are finally looking up a little bit for this defense as they get ready to head to play the Buffalo Bills. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at CorbinSmithNFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. Subscribe to our show, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts, by going to our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. When we return for our Tuesday show, it's Throwback Tuesday. We're going to look back at the last couple times the Seahawks got to face off against the Buffalo Bills, AFC East matchup. Only play every 4 years, but we'll look back at the last couple times that they've played. And of course, we're going to look at some offensive takeaways from Sunday's victory over the 49ers. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Go Hawks!